On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. In April of 1992, when the Rodney King riots broke out, I had quit the television news business and I was looking for something to do. The civil disturbance was still going on when Ruth Seymour, then KCRW's general manager, asked me to host 1 hour on the radio with a few guests in the studio and open phone lines. The audience responded, and I was asked back for another day, another week, another month, and so on as the conversations evolved into the program Which Way LA. The program is ending tonight, but the question lingers on, and this will not be the last time I'll be asking it on KCRW. Frances Anderton is with me in the studio. She is a former Which Way LA producer, now host of KCRW's DNA, Design and Architecture. We have a lot of very interesting people on the line, and our first guest tonight is Kevin Starr. He is the former state librarian, historian of California, author of a multi-volume history of the California Dream. Kevin Starr, it's always great to hear from you. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to hear from you, Warren.
Okay, I've set it up this way. What's your answer to the question, Which Way LA?
Well, I think the Which Way for the future is the fashioning of a new narrative for the city, a new metaphor, but a narrative, a story that has to be anchored in maturity and self-confidence and a sense of leadership on the part of the city. We've had the narratives before in sequence. I mean, you had Oz, you had the Great Thirst during the building of waterworks, Oil Dorado, Hollywood, the Hollywood Canteen. Then you had the court of L.A. Noir in the 30s and 40s, the Rams and Dodgers of L.A. in the 50s, the City of Quartz, Mike Davis's book some 25 years ago that sort of led to Ramparts L.A., if you will. And then a much more hopeful lately, a kind of ecumenopolis L.A., a multicultural L.A. Now, none of these other L.A.s disappear in this new narrative, but I think a new narrative could be fashioned very, very dramatically from the point of view of middle-class value in the city. I think you could almost make the point that that for whatever problems L.A. has, it is an absolute triumph of middle class for other reasons, a fusion of middle-classness and immigrant middle-classness, university research. I think the newspaper, I think it's very necessary to get one kind of major newspaper in local hands, and then entertainment in the sense of providing the stories and dreams in motion pictures and television and other formats as well, the stories and dreams that our culture needs now to stabilize itself, having gone through so much transition. So I think there's plenty of work for Los Angeles to do, or for Los Angelinos to do, or there's plenty of work that will be anchored in Los Angeles, and from this will, I think, come this new narrative, this more 21st century sense of maturity and leadership and self-confidence.
Kevin Starr, you're a great guest. We have 45 minutes. You have given us 5 hours worth of stuff to talk about. Let me start with the idea of middle-class values. Los Angeles is a place of boom and bust, and it may be booming, but isn't the middle class kind of being forced out right now, particularly with rents going so high and the price of housing so high?
Absolutely. All the above is true. The middle class is in trouble in this country. This is a national concern. But you have a fusion of a family sense. You have immigration in Los Angeles. You have family units remaining intact among the immigrant groups of a variety of immigrant groups. You have then the concatenation, if you will, of smaller incomes through families, and then the family purchase of housing. Families are sticking together and as such are acquiring a kind of communal buying power. Now, even this is extending to families by metaphor. Single people are buying homes together. People are sharing cars. People are learning to rent a wedding gown. There's all sorts of techniques going on now in which middle-class values are sort of being refinanced on a more cooperative basis that reprises what a family does.
Kevin Starr, again, a former state librarian, historian of California, a frequent guest on our program. We'll come back to you as our program goes forward. I first want to introduce Manuel Pastor. He's a professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity at USC. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Glad to be back with you.
Very interested to hear you, then, follow up on what we just heard from Kevin Starr. He talks about immigrant groups. This, of course, the most diverse city in the nation, if not in the world. Almost any nationality, ethnic group, religion that you can name, there are more people here that answer to it than any place else in the country outside the mother country, in the world, I should say, outside the mother country.
Yeah, I think that's one of our strengths going forward. I mean, I would echo a lot of Kevin's optimism, maybe from some slightly different sources, but I would echo that tone, in part because, you know, it's important to realize that Which Way L.A. got started literally in the context of a city on fire, of a city riven by interracial conflict, of a city in which the stark negative policing had been exposed, in a city in which the stark and widening inequalities had driven what essentially amounted to a bread riot that blew the city up. And it's actually kind of, if you think about this going back to those times, hard to imagine that 20, 25 years later, we'd be at a city that is leading the nation in terms of trying to raise the minimum wage to deal with at least one part of the economic crisis, forging new kinds of strategies to integrate immigrants, really beginning to build a very different built environment in terms of transit and transit-oriented housing, and really trying to take the lead as well in terms of climate and dealing with climate issues. So if you look at the fact that Which Way LA was a civic conversation prompted by desperation, we now have had an arc which I think is due in large part to the kinds of conversations coming together, visioning, and struggles for justice that have animated Los Angeles for the last 20, 25 years. And so I think we stand with lots of contradictions, the kind you mentioned with regard to housing, forcing a lot of people out of the city, people being left behind, et cetera. But we stand in a moment in which we can have a new civic conversation, not out of desperation, but out of really transformation about the future.
Do you see the same communal behavior that was mentioned by Kevin Starr, people getting together, sharing things that they can't afford to do on their own?
Well, I think it's in, I think Kevin is pointing to an important thing. I can say that in part because I have my own millennial children and they're certainly sharing to be able to make the world work. You certainly see this with immigrant communities too. But, you know, you can take a place like South Los Angeles, which in 1980 was about 60% African American. In 1970, it was about 80% African American. Now it's about two-thirds Latino. And as that transformation took place, there were lots of tensions and conflicts. And while there's still tensions and conflicts in a place like South Los Angeles, there's also lots of cooperation, people coming together, trying to get parks cleaned up in their communities, trying to do better policing in their communities, trying to fight for economic justice in their communities. So I think the communal nature comes from the kind of sharing that Kevin is talking about in terms of economics, but also a recognition that our destinies are interwoven and that if we want to have an LA that's healthy in the future, we can't have the kind of conflicts, divisions, and tensions that drove the situation that gave birth to your radio program.
Manuel Pastor, again at USC, professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity. Erin Aubrey Kaplan is with us, Los Angeles-based journalist and columnist. Her books include the forthcoming I Heart Obama and Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line, Dispatches from a Black Journalista. Good to have you on our program.
Always good to be on, Warren. Sorry this is the last time.
Well, it won't be the last time. I'm still going to be around. We're going to be doing Olney in L.A. We'll tell you about that a little bit later.
Okay.
But first, let me ask you, what about the kind of evolution that our other two guests have talked to, and very importantly and obviously the shift that Manuel Pastor just described from a time when African-Americans had 60% of Los Angeles, South Los Angeles, I should say, to the time now when it's two-thirds Latino?
Right. Well, I was thinking about that, also thinking about what Kevin Starr said. It's almost like I've lived in at least two LAs. There, at least two. I started kind of the same time you did in journalism in '92 when the unrest happened. And
you're
I
that
started,
old?
Yeah, I started when I was eight.
okay.
So I have sort of, you know, in my mind, documented the narrative of black communities in LA, which, you know, the black community was South Central and Crenshaw, and now in 2016, I have to say, I mean, I really get the optimism that Kevin Starr is talking about. LA has always been a forward-looking city, and in fact, you know, my folks came from New Orleans and other people came from the South because Los Angeles was really such a comparatively wonderful place for black people. It was, you know, for all kinds of reasons. But I have to say, you know, it really feels like things have stood still from my vantage point. Employment for black people is really pretty, you know, critical. We have the police brutality issue, which, you know, kind of touched off 92. In so many ways, we're just kind of standing still. And in the meantime, as Manuel Pastor was saying, demographics are changing, have been changing ever since I've been writing, and are changing pretty much more rapidly. And there's a great sense in black LA that there's no more black LA left. And what are we to do? Where are we to go? It's almost an existential crisis. And while there's a lot of cooperation across, you know, color lines, because there has to be. I mean, I live in Inglewood, where it is becoming more Latino, and that's just, you know, it's just the way of not just the past and the present, but the future. I really don't know where the black community will end up. There's a lot of change happening. There's a lot of positive change, you know, change coming to Leimert Park, you know, with the rail and the developments, but there is a great sense still that black people are being left out of this change, out of this, out of these improvements. And it's very frustrating because this is just kind of the running in place that I've seen and written about for, you know, more than 20 years now.
Kevin Starr earlier mentioned the era, as he put it, of the Rams and the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. So what about the Rams coming back to Inglewood?
Well, I lost that bet. I didn't think they would come back. And it's interesting. This is, I've written many times before that a sports franchise, you know, by itself doesn't improve a city. We had the Lakers, of course, and the Kings, and, you know, since 1967 at the Forum. And it was sort of modular. You know, people would come in to the town and leave, and it didn't translate automatically into improvements for locals. And so this development is different. It is not just the stadium. It is retail and residential, and it's sort of like, you know, people are comparing it to L.A. Live. I guess I'm calling it, in my mind, Inglewood Live, but I don't know how transformational it will be. It could be very self-contained and just sort of be a bubble, or it could be something that will finally have beneficial effects for, our example, our downtown, which has been languishing for decades. And meantime, I've seen Culver City, I've seen Santa Monica, I've seen all sorts of downtowns and, you know, central places in town flourish. And it's just frustrating to see it not happen in a place like Inglewood. Hopefully, this new, you know, multi-billion-dollar development will do the trick. If it doesn't, I just don't know what will.
Let me introduce DJ Waldy. He has written dramatically, poetically, and eloquently about Los Angeles for a long, long time. He's currently blogging for KCET TV. Important for this conversation, he retired in 2010 from his position as deputy city manager of the city of Lakewood. Don Waldy, always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren, very much.
Tell us about the smaller cities in Los Angeles. We've talked about it as a large region. We've heard Aaron Aubrey Kaplan talk a little bit about South L.A., as did Manuel Pastor, and about Inglewood, of course. But there's a lot of other cities, 87 of them, or 88, rather, just in Los Angeles County.
That's right, Warren, and perhaps this is a chance to reframe some of our conversation, because, of course, we've been talking about which way L.A., and we've been tending to conflate L.A. and the city of Los Angeles as one thing, and of course it's not. L.A. is a great big thing, and it has, as you said, 88 different cities in it, and most of them are smaller. A couple of them are larger, like Long Beach and Burbank and Glendale, but most of them are smaller cities, some of them quite small. Their fate in the coming century will largely define what Los Angeles is, that big thing we call L.A. Not all of them are on the same track. Some have serious problems, but they're all facing a similar changed in demographics, similar changes in economics. And they're also staying the same in many ways. So this pattern of change and stasis that your other guests have pointed to is certainly is characteristic of the suburban fringe of Los Angeles.
You're with KCET. You have written a great deal, as I indicated. I'm at KCRW. Kevin Starr mentioned earlier the Los Angeles Times and the need for there to be journalism in this area. DJ Waldie, are the smaller cities getting lost in the consciousness, the overall consciousness of the region as a whole?
It has happened, and it may continue in the future. A grave loss to the communities of L.A. County has been the decline of local news reporting, local newspapers. The L.A. Times has not always been an adequate resource for the kind of political news, community news that makes political life possible in the small cities of the county. We do need to have a robust conversation at the neighborhood level to hold together the political life of the communities of Los Angeles County.
Do you see that happening because of social media, for example, and the digitalization of communications?
Some of it's happening. I'm uncertain whether it will be enough. Kevin spoke about a new narrative arising in L.A. That new narrative will require a great deal of shared conversation. Aaron talked about communities being left out of the narrative. We need to include those communities in the narrative. And I'm not sure if the 21st century social media will be adequate to that. I do know from a personal conviction that the LA Times or something like it needs to be part of the narrative.
We have with us Christopher Hawthorne, architecture critic for the L.A. Times, although it's not in that capacity as an L.A. Times person that we have him with us. Manuel Pastor mentioned the built environment. That, of course, is what Christopher Hawthorne deals with, and he's chairing the Third L.A. Project. He's a professor of urban and environmental policy at Occidental, and he's talking about this issue. Christopher, good to have you on our program again.
Thanks so much for having me, Warren, and really congratulations on the great success of the program.
Well, thank you. Tell us about the Third LA Project, and are you working toward a new narrative for Los Angeles?
I've been thinking about a new narrative and how one might frame a new story, a new narrative about Los Angeles. I think everyone is sensing now that we're in a transitional moment. Mayor Garcetti has talked about this being a hinge moment. Of course, as Kevin Starr and other guests have mentioned, this has always been a city of flux, a city of boom and bust. Karen McWilliams said the history of Los Angeles is a history of booms. But I think the sense of change and transition is really more pronounced now. I think we're asking a lot of big and, as others have said, really existential questions about what kind of place we're becoming, what kind of place we want to be. I don't know that we always have perfect ready-made answers to that question. I think we maybe have a better sense of what we're leaving behind or beginning to leave behind than what we're becoming or turning into. So the idea of the Third Los Angeles means that this hinge is not just a kind of binary transition from point A to point B. We're not just moving into a kind of post-suburban Los Angeles, but it's also taking a longer view of the history of LA and remembering that this hasn't always been a city of cars and freeways and subdivisions and a concrete river, that we have a really rich pre-war history, when some of the things that we're trying to add now, mass transit, really innovative multifamily housing, we produced in really remarkable quantity. So it makes sense to think of this new phase not just as a post-suburban Los Angeles, but as a third Los Angeles. Now, in other ways, it's really different. We face a lot of new questions. I think others have mentioned demographics. I think hollowing out of certain kinds of manufacturing and industry, of course, climate change and new ecological questions about resources, water, the top of that list. But I think most dramatic of all in certain ways is what's really new is this is becoming a post-growth city. If we had one industry here besides Hollywood, it was the growth machine itself. And I think we're not growing at the rate we did. This is not a city of new immigrants anymore. Immigration to LA County really peaked 25 years ago, around 1990. It's a city of second-generation immigrants. So the question for me is, how do we deal with these new headwinds? How do we begin to think about a city that's not driven by growth and infinite expansion and thinking that it sort of can grow and expand its way out of every major problem? I think the one silver lining there is that we finally have a chance after a century of really rapid growth to finally take a little time to consolidate our gains and catch our breath a little bit and really think about these questions about what kind of place we want to be.
Let me introduce Robert Kleinhans. He is the chief economist for the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
It's a real pleasure, Warren. Thank you.
Do you agree we're in a post-growth phase, particularly given LA's involvement in the global economy, the fact that we have two of the largest ports in the country, and an immigrant population? But has growth slowed down? Is it time, as Christopher Hawthorne suggests, to take a breather?
Well, it was also suggested that we go through huge economic cycles, ups and downs, and indeed that's been the case over the last 20-odd years that you've been on the air with this program. We've seen a lot of challenges economically as well as socially, as we've already heard, with key industries such as aerospace that have lost jobs but still maintain a presence and an important presence here. So to put some numbers and perspective on this, yes, we've added about 1 million people of working age population over the past 25 years. But we've only added about 140,000 wage and salary jobs. In other words, over the last 20-odd years, we've seen some successes, but we've also seen some challenges that we have not met. Having said that, I think looking forward, we've got the building blocks for a successful future. I think it is going to be one of growth because you look at goods movement, which, given the global economy, we would expect to grow. Entertainment, we think, is well poised to continue to maintain its key role here in the local economy. About 30% of all the jobs nationally in this industry are here in L.A. County. Even aerospace has a promising future, but it's transformed itself. The digital revolution and the arrival of so many tech firms from the Bay Area to set up shop here tells us that there's another aspect of the local economy that in all likelihood is going to be here for a long time and have great potential for growth. We heard earlier about the diversity of the population here, and I think that is one of our great assets looking forward. So I think we should expect that the local economy will grow in the future, maybe not at the pace that it grew in the immediate post-World War II era, but one would expect and hope that it'll grow at least as fast as it has over the last 20 years or so.
Let me quickly go back to our first guest, Kevin Starr, the former state librarian, historian of California. And you mentioned that California has gone through so many different eras, each with a different narrative. What about the era of the red cars? One of the projects that Christopher Hawthorne is working on has to do with the idea that we can now restore rail transit as we had before World War II, before the massive red car system was taken down, and redesign the city in a way by setting up transportation corridors and then having denser population along them. Is that a way of combining both the past and the future?
Absolutely, because the big red cars could take you out from downtown Los Angeles to Santa Monica, let's just say, much more quickly than you could get there driving today. And that Los Angeles invented itself, starting in the 1890s, early 1900s, with the rise of the big red cars and also the yellow cars in the city proper. It invented itself through mass transportation, through shared transportation. And that led to, the population growth. It led to the Great Thirst period. And it led to El Dorado. All that came out of the red cars. Now, remember also, as Raynard Bonham talks about in his wonderful book, The Four Ecologies, that red car line also built upon the cattle lines, the cattle trails of the Spanish and Mexican era, which also then built upon the migration and trading trails of the Native American period. So in effect, we're going back to a future that envelops not just the red cars, but also the way that our predecessors in Aboriginal times got through the region. So I think that's the uses of history. Things can be put aside for a while, and they can be recovered again. You can make an argument, and I'm the planner, the professor planning can correct me or not, that one of Los Angeles' great contributions to civilization was made in the 1920s when it invented a technique that you could take a safe left turn onto oncoming traffic.
Woody Allen, of course, said the great thing about Los Angeles and California is you can turn right on red.
Right, but that's right. And the red car set that up, and then when the automobile came, and there was the obvious competition, but at the same time, the automobile built upon this orientation towards transportation for instance, one of the things that's always interested me about a great Los Angelino, Ray Bradbury, was his constant interest in planning as it cross-referenced science fiction, that the imagined better world in science fiction or worse world was also very much parallel to the process of Los Angeles imagining itself and planning. And Bradbury, in the 1950s, was talking about putting monorails up and down the 405 and all sorts of things that seem futuristic. But, of course, then Disneyland put the monorails there, and it takes a little time for us to absorb that. And who knows what wonderful things will come back in the 21st century. Carrying a freight, for instance, we left the dirigible behind. Of course, we have the Goodyear blimp that goes over our football games. But the dirigible, the great, who knows in the future that great masses of freight may be lifted by powerful lighter-than-air aircraft and moved across cityscapes without the necessity of clogging roads. And so that side of things, that we've only just begun to experiment some of the people call the steampunk aspects, i.e., in other words, a combination of Victorian machinery doing very modern things.
Okay. Again, Kevin Starr, the historian of California. Frances Anderton, as I indicated, is here with me in the studio. She is a KCRW former producer of this program, Which Way LA. She's now host of her own program, DNA, Design and Architecture, and she has
something to say.
No, I'm not going to say you just have something to say. She also studies the very issues that we have been talking about with all of our other guests, particularly with regard to the built environment and the dependence of Los Angeles on the past and the hope for the future.
But I should start by saying that anything I learned about journalism, I learned at the feet of Warren Olney. It's been such an incredible education to have worked with Warren over these years. But no, I want to actually start with the book Kevin Starr opened by talking about the middle class. And I was so intrigued by his analysis, where he argues that we're still seeing a kind of very positive kind of middle classness in Los Angeles, that we have this collaborative way of doing so. We have more sort of sharing of living spaces and so on. And that seems to fly in the face of conventional wisdom right now, which is that we're in a way seeing the paradox of success, which is back in the 90s, when it was the period of City on Fire, City of Courts, property was cheap. You could rent, you could buy, you could get a somewhat generous amount of space for an affordable amount of money, and you had some space on the roads. What we have now, I would say, is kind of a contraction of space. We have the sense of limitless space is very definitely being challenged. I would say that's the major existential kind of change that we're grappling with in Los Angeles. And in terms of affordability, it's very definitely being squeezed. I think the numbers, we should turn to Robert Kleinhans for specifics, but I think it's something like over 50% of Angelenos now rent, and of renters, a large number is paying something like two-thirds of their income on rent. This is not the place of infinite possibility that it used to be, an infinite affordability. It has many other blessings and enormous assets as we move forward. But I certainly would question the notion of LA's sort of continued middle classness. We should say also it's become a global city. You mentioned it's part of the global economy. We have such global investment coming in that's now competing with local. And so I think we're in the middle of quite a challenging time
Let me go back to Robert Kleinhans again, chief economist for the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation. What do you say to that?
Well, first off, let's just keep in mind that L.A. County is like a state within a very large state. And, yes, forever, you know, ever since really the post-World War era began, we have been an expensive place to live as a state and as a county. Affordability here is always a challenge under the best of circumstances. We have for decades had more renters than homeowners, believe it or not, here in Los Angeles County, not true of other parts of Southern California. It's a challenging place to live. And to the point that was made several times on the program, we've had a hollowing out, if you will, of basic middle class jobs. And that's occurred over the last 25 years or so. So it's made it difficult for a typical household to raise a family and give their kids opportunity. And, of course, it's made it difficult for, say, an aspiring actor or an aspiring creative person who sees that this is where he or she wants to get a start on things to be able to make ends meet. And that's a challenge that we've faced for quite some time, and I think it's not going to go away anytime soon. It is a very expensive place to live. The fact that we are increasingly global will make it even more so going forward. And that certainly is one of many challenges that we have to face up to and tackle.
DJ Waldy, back to you. 88 cities in Los Angeles County alone. Is this something that can be tackled city by city, or does it have to be approached region-wide?
It can't be tackled city by city. But, Warren, locality still matters. Our trajectory toward the future is not going to be defined by abandoning the characteristics of individual communities, the reasons why people want to live there, the stories to tell about their lives there. Cities in Los Angeles County already cooperate in ways that are difficult for those outside the county to understand. Half the cities in the county are contract cities in contract with the County of Los Angeles for many of their municipal services. Other cities contract with other cities. The dynamics of relationship among the cities in L.A. County is distinct and needs to be better understood if we're to get a handle on how common problems can be solved at the local level with the political forces and the resources and the stories of the people who live there.
Christopher Hawthorne, back to you, working on the third L.A. project. What about the transportation system, and does it have the capacity, do you think, to get big enough, be important enough, especially given recent reports about how ridership is declining, to actually help unify the city, or, and I should say the region, or is that becoming a fading dream?
Well, I think Kevin Starr is right to remind us about the incredible scope of the original red car system and how far it could take you. And it took many decades to build out that system. And now we're trying to put a new system in a much more built out, much more crowded, much more expensive city. And so we're really in the early days of this transition in terms of mobility. Measure R was passed in 2008, and we've just begun to see new lines that are built on that investment. I think that the story that my colleagues at the Times just wrote this week about declining ridership is a really important one. There's serious questions about Metro, where it's allocating those resources, particularly as it gets ready to ask taxpayers perhaps to extend those tax hikes another several decades. But I would say it's too soon to tell about the success or failure of that experiment. It's a major, major shift. We spent many decades investing in freeways and cars and that infrastructure that really supported the single-family house and the kind of private subdivision that we think of as dominating post-war Los Angeles. So it may be another full decade before we can really begin to, A, build a kind of mature transit system that reaches more corners of this huge region, and B, begin to gauge the success of this
huge new investment in a different kind of mobility.
Manuel Pastor, back to you, professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity at USC. We heard a moment ago a differentiation between the first generation of immigrants and now the second generation. Is the second generation, and in some cases the third and fourth, are they more likely, do you think, to use communal services like rapid transit rather than sticking together in smaller communities and dividing themselves off from the whole?
Actually, we tend to see that the longer people have been in the United States and generationally, they actually tend to use transit less. And so I think one of the really key issues is to make the transit system convenient so that people to stick to it. But it's an important transformation that you're pointing out that's going on in the city and in the county, actually, in the metro area. The share of foreign-born in Los Angeles County has actually been on the decline for the last 3 or 4 years. It's a much more homegrown population. Of the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the United States, the only large metro that did not see an increase in the number of Hispanic children is Los Angeles, partly because, as Chris Hawthorne was mentioning, we're a post-growth city, less people being attracted, because the family and living patterns are getting closer and fertility patterns to those of other folks in the United States. So what that means is that we're not going to necessarily in the future have as much of the pressures of population growth, but we will have the economic needs that Robert was talking about. When you add 1 million new folks, but you don't add more than 100,000 jobs, we need at this point to be able to grow the economy, and in particular to grow the middle of the economy, to make sure that we can actually secure that middle class that Kevin Starr is talking about. And while we're doing that, we need to be particularly intentional about inclusion. Aaron is absolutely right about Black Angelenos having been left out of the economic development that's taking place, and about a sense of a city that's being lost to them politically, economically, and otherwise. This is a city and a region that essentially willed itself into existence. It brought water from Owens Valley. It transformed sleepy harbors into ports. It created a transit system. It's a city that willed itself into political transformation by deciding to elect Mayor Tom Bradley in a city that was not majority Black, but viewed Bradley as a transformational figure. This is a city that can will itself into a very different future, but it's going to require political coalitions, new narratives, vision, and the kind of intentional policy that some of us have been talking about.
Aaron Arby Kaplan, back to you. Mayor Tom Bradley was in the very end of his final term when the Rodney King civil disturbance broke out and when this program began. Have African Americans, do you think, felt excluded since then, despite the fact that this was the first large city in the United States to elect a Black mayor, and he served for 5 terms?
Oh, yeah, I think there was a big disconnect that people have always recognized. I mean, the symbolism of Tom Bradley was tremendous, and I can't help but think here of Barack Obama, you know, first Black mayor of a city that's not majority Black by any stretch. And, you know, it was Tom Bradley mainly benefited the political class, you know, people who worked with him within the government. There was some, you know, there were some benefits, but the majority of Black people did not prosper under Tom Bradley, didn't prosper under any mayor, really. And, I think this sounds a little brutal, but Tom Bradley was a hero to people who, you know, pushed that coalition, which was seen as very progressive, and it was. But on the ground, Black people, you know, were left out of that. And that's kind of hard to accept, but it's true. I remember one of the things I remember reporting on was there was a movement years ago by then Councilman Nate Holden to rename Crenshaw Boulevard Tom Bradley Boulevard. It seemed the natural thing. You know, Tom Bradley grew up in the neighborhood. He was, you know, a political hero, et cetera. There was great resistance to that. People did not go for it. The residents did not want to rename the street and the boulevard. And it kind of surprised me, confirmed for me, kind of this disconnect between the symbolism of Black people and the reality of Black people, kind of, embodied by Tom Bradley.
Kevin Starr, we're almost out of time, and I want to go back to Frances Anderton, whose show is beginning to look at the influence of entertainment on the culture. But very quickly, if you can, how important is Hollywood?
I think Hollywood's more important than ever. All the changes, all the transitions. Think of something like gay marriage. If I said gay marriage 25, 30 years ago, you'd say, in your dreams, the 22nd century, perhaps, or something. Look at the transitions, the psychological transitions, the relationships between parents and grandparents and children, relationships between various ethnic groups, some of the tensions that are suggested here. We need, and we're getting, especially with the new kind of attitude of Hollywood, like say somebody like Roy Price and Amazon.com doing that, those short-term 5 to 6 to 7 television series that are based on real problems. And I think Cecil B. DeMille's started to do movies in the 1920s when Los Angeles filled up with people coming from rural backgrounds. He did a lot of movies showing the sophistication and technologies of living an urban life. And his brother, William DeMille, wrote a book on Hollywood, and he says, we need stories and dreams. Well, we need those stories and dreams more than ever, because that's the way human beings connect to each other. That's the way they think through their problems, through narrative and through the dream life. And the entertainment world has to deal with this. Now,
I'm going to interrupt you because in the interest of time, Frances, you at DNA, your program, Design and Architecture, you've been talking about this.
Well, yes, talking very much about actual physical space, but to the extent that the entertainment industry plays a part of that story, you were making me think as you discuss, one could take two films, say, that represent perhaps the past and the future of LA. One is Straight Outta Compton, the movie, if anyone's seen it. It's a wonderful movie, but it brings us right back to that period, basically, when Which Way LA started, and it was a time of a birth of a musical culture, but also it was a time of tremendous injustices within the African-American community in LA. Okay, so then fast forward to the movie, say, Her, came out a couple of years ago, a year or so ago. Boy, what an image of LA in the future that movie represented. It was an image of us all living in high rises, of the single family house couldn't even be seen. There was, in fact, there was barely a car in that movie. We were all going around smoothly in mass transit and living in glass towers with marvelous views. So yes, the entertainment industry, that certainly gives us narratives to get back right to Kevin Starr's ask at the beginning of this discussion, what is the new Los Angeles narrative? I think if we are running out of time, I have a special job to do, which is I have to read some of the comments that we have received from listeners. So many people are so sorry, Warren, that this show is going off the air, but they should know that you are going to be staying on the air with Only in LA, which you're going to tell us about in a second. But I do want to read a few of the notes that we got. Let's start with Gregory Ronquillo. I hope I said your name correctly, Gregory. The civil discussions found on Which Way LA was the only thing keeping me from throwing a trash can through a window on a daily basis. See, you have kept us calm, Warren, in the face of craziness. Ted Herman, I love when he interviews a low-level bureaucrat who hasn't learned yet that they're supposed to avoid answering tough questions. That's when Warren gets the really good answers. Promise us you will continue to get the really good answers. Ed Yerk Robbins says, end of an era. Thank you, Warren and KCRW. It's definitely helped me stay abreast of issues all around the Southland, including cities and neighborhoods I've yet to experience myself. And I think all of us can attest to the way you have brought this entire region alive through your programming. None of us can be everywhere, but through Which Way LA, we feel like we're everywhere. Alex Johnson tweets, Warren Olney and Which Way LA for your significant... Oh, thank you. Sorry, TY. Warren Olney and Which Way LA for your significant contribution to civil discourse on critical issues. Robert Wisdom, my heart is broken. For years, I'd take the long way in LA traffic just for this show. Well, now, of course, you could just sit and just drive from here to the 405 and you'd hear the entire show. Peter Eliasberg, he's a guest, ACLU attorney. If it did not raise serious First Amendment problems, I would race into court to seek a court order requiring that Which Way LA remain on the air. So that's just a few of the plaudits, Warren. But tell us what you're doing next.
Well, I'm very touched by all of that, and thank you. But that's enough. And I'm very touched and very, very flattered by all of it. It's maybe the end of an era. It's really the end of a program, and hopefully the era will continue. I just hope that I'm good for all the windows in the listening area and that people won't be throwing anything through them any longer. It has been my honor and privilege to host this program for all these years. I couldn't have done it without a succession of extraordinary producers, too numerous to name, and a great production staff. Thanks, of course, to all the people, including those guests tonight, who have been on this program. But they're not off the hook, and neither are the staff or the producers. I'm still going to be hosting our nationally syndicated program, To the Point, as well as a new series called Olney in L.A. It'll be cropping up on All Things Considered and Morning Edition and in other places as well, and will continue to serve this very, very attentive, very responsive audience, the loyal listeners, as well as the honest critics. You are the ones who make it all worthwhile. Thank you all. And thank you all, our guests today on our last version of Which Way LA.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you so much, Warren.
Thank you, Warren.
Honored to be a part, and thanks for your ears at this, Warren.